Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 14, Interview with Chuck Worsham. Hi, this is Tim.
And this is Gina, and this is the podcast that makes you soar, sail, and swoop on the sport of dog sledding.
Soar, sail, and swoop. I got this one down. This one's pretty easy. Hey, well, this interview is with Chuck Worsham from Alaska Sky Trekking, and it's all about flying. Yeah.
Pretty much.
And it's all about his adventures and the things that he has been able to do while flying for not only the Iditarod, but also for, I guess, just traveling around all over Alaska and Canada.
Yeah.
Which is fun. So we've got a great show today. Chuck is going to be here, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about what some of the neat things that they're seeing in Alaska, what they have done as far as traveling up the Iditarod Trail, and how he manages to get people in the right spot at the right time.
Yep. Talks a little bit, too, about the Iditarod Trail, which we're kind of gearing up for, trying to get more interviews that really explain the Iditarod Trail so we can all... We always hear about certain sections like the Dalzell Gorge and things like that, but what about the rest of the trail? And so we asked Chuck about those things, as well as some fun stories that he had flying up and down the Iditarod.
Yeah, fun stories, white knucklers, all kinds of good stories, which is pretty funny. So yeah, it's a pretty interesting interview. It's not very long, so it won't be a really long show today, but we've also got a Dr. Tim vet tip, and it's all about unconventional training. So it should be fun. Different ways to train your dogs in the summer months, and we've got some really neat ideas in there.
We also want to put a shout out to Carrie Hinesley from the PSDSA, which is the Pacific Sled Dog and Skeeter Association. Thanks so much for putting a link or putting some information about the Sled Dog Podcast on your newsletter or website. We
really
greatly appreciate that. Anybody else who has a newsletter or website, if they could note or put www.sleddogpodcast.com. We greatly appreciate it. The more listeners, the more people get to learn.
Yeah, exactly. We've got quite a few folks already listening, but it gets us motivated to do more. You know, in this sport, it's really an interesting sport. I'm not sure how horseback riders do or motocross and so forth, but sponsorship is such a big importance with this sport, not only for the dog sledders, and the mushers, but the skeegers, everyone to be able to, you know, help carry the weight of this relatively expensive sport. So, like everybody else, we are also looking for sponsors. So if you happen to want your product mentioned or promoted, please let us know. We're looking for a couple sponsors. We've had some interested parties, but they really don't...
Jive.
Yeah, they really don't jive. They really don't mix in with what we're looking at. So we want to make sure that they are something relevant that you guys would want to hear about. So anyways, if you have something or you have a product, whether it be snow hooks and bags and that kind of stuff, or sleds or anything else, please let us know. We'd love to put you on the air. Also, a couple other things is we've got some great feedback. There's quite a few people that have put their email address in on our website, which allows them to get notified automatically when there's a new podcast. So I know we're kind of sporadic, about every week, week and a half. And so if you want the podcast to automatically come to your email address, or at least the a notice saying that there's a new podcast out there, go ahead and put your email on the website. It's on the left-hand side. Just drop it in there. There's no spam, no nothing. And nobody really sees your email except for the system that automatically generates every time we do a new podcast. So it's kind of cool. So we're in racing season here in Michigan. Hopefully all of you have had a great opportunity to jump in and either see some races or participate in some races.
And if you're wondering where all the snow is, if you don't have any, well, it's in Michigan.
Wow, do we have snow.
It's in northern Michigan. We have a ton of snow, and we have a lot of cold weather. It was super cold today.
Yeah, this last weekend with the race, not only did we have wonderful snow because there was a lot, but it was negative 10.
Yeah,
for
we left the race
Michigan,
at negative 10, and it went to negative 12.
Yeah.
But by the time we were racing, it was in single digits at least.
Yeah,
at least for the kids.
Yeah.
So keep everything covered and safe.
It was exciting.
We had a great race last weekend. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's five of us in the family that run, and we ran, six races? And we
tried to do weight pull with our dog Royal, and he just decided not to participate at all. We had been training him, doing well with him. And by the way, that's probably going to be an upcoming podcast, is on the weight pull. So I don't know if anybody else does weight pull within their club. Their little
local
thing.
Obviously, we don't.
We tried.
Yeah.
Actually, we used a dog last year and placed. We got this new Siberian. We kind of rescued him, so to speak. He's a great, strong dog, but I tell you what, and I worked with him and had it down. I'm snacking him. He was pulling, and he was up to almost 300 pounds and pulling.
I think it was all the people. There was a lot of people at this
meeting. And he got hooked up, looked around, and he said, not doing it. Wouldn't even try to pull.
There was something about the day, because I think out of the 12 or 15 people that were there weight pulling, I think only three dogs actually pulled anything. So it was a very strange
day. And it was cold. I was done. I had actually run a four-mile race and then a five-mile race, and so quite frankly, when he didn't want to pull, I was like, fine, let's go.
Back to the trailer. Exactly.
Time to go home.
Yes, it's been a fun year so far. We did get our trailer. I asked early on about how do you transfer 20, 25 dogs, and we got a little cargo trailer and loaded up with dog boxes and built all. Of course, you know, I couldn't have done this in the summertime. I had to wait till December to get the trailer, right? So I'm out there in the snow trying to build boxes, but they don't look too bad.
We got
a little heater in there, so we're all happy and warm and
cozy.
Now I just need a truck to pull. But hey, one thing at a time.
You sound like Lance Mackey.
Yeah, I know. Lance, I love you, man. It's all about the truck. I completely connect with
you. Our truck is just fine.
Yeah,
it will do for this winter. Yeah. It's just fine.
Exactly.
So we've been busy. We have another race coming up. We're actually racing for the next 5 weeks, so it's going to be a little tough. Pushing out podcasts. We have some things just sitting here ready to go on, and we're getting them out as soon as we can. But we've had lots of little things going on in our life too. So
yeah, Shoney, the retired sled dog who's on our stories, about a week and a half ago, we had a melt off here in northern Michigan, and it got so warm and so foggy. I think it was a Monday morning. We let her out. She actually stays in the house with us, and we let her out to go potty, and she went out and she didn't come back. So probably about 4 or 5 o'clock, we're out there in this deep fog traveling around the area. On the golf cart, walking, everything, yelling her name, and she's a little hard of hearing, we think. So it was a pretty tough thing. Well, she never came back. We went in, it's like day two, we started doing the flyers. You know, running down to the corners and around us, probably 5 or 10 miles, putting flyers out. Had a funny story where even the local radio station had talked about somebody had found a husky and called in the radio station, and so other folks had called us saying, hey, they think they found him, and then we couldn't find who it was, and it was just crazy, and it wasn't the dog.
She's an Alaskan, and she's yellow. She almost looks like a coyote.
Yeah.
And we live in the middle of 40 acres, and then there's
probably
acreage adjoining it. So, and we have swamp, and we were really concerned that she head out into the swamp. But we kept hoping maybe somebody would find her. But the thing is she's tagged. And so as the day three came to us, we thought no one's found her because they could easily just call. And no one had called. So we were pretty upset.
You know, it's amazing. That whole thing was kind of, I don't know how to describe it. I imagine a lot of people have lost dogs, but there's nothing worse. Well, I mean, imagine there is. I guess if you lost a child or something like that. But it's just a sinking feeling because you don't know what happened. You don't know if she got hit by a car. You don't know if she ran away. You don't know if she's traveling still in the woods. You don't know if she's hurt.
We kept
hoping
she was found, but we kept thinking she's not found.
Yeah, so
she's
really
out
bizarre.
She's 12 years old.
Yeah.
You know, we just were so worried because she's 12 years old, and we thought, okay, we know her time is short as it is, but for some reason we just didn't want her dying anywhere but in our arms. So
the the interesting thing about all of this was that she traveled through the swamp, went through probably about, 10,000 acres of swamp, and she traveled and got on the other side of the swamp and came out of the swamp and came up to a gentleman's house. And so Jeff Sharp, we really appreciate you finding our dog. And he called the vet because the vet's tag was on there, and the vet called us because we'd called the vet. And sure enough, we went over and picked her up to find a very tired, cold, 12-year-old skinny dog.
Actually, when I saw her, almost had tears in my eyes because I thought, okay, I'm not ready for you to go. I wanted to find her because I didn't want her to die in the woods all by herself.
Yeah.
But then I thought, no, I don't want you to die at all. And it looked like she was gonna. She was pretty beat up.
But she's doing great.
Yep. But within a day, I mean, she's scarfed food down, and she's always been a really picky eater. So get her to eat is amazing. And she's just fine. She's back being Shoney, and
She's sleeping on the bed.
Oh, did you want to come and say hello, Shoney?
Nice. Hey,
well,
Shoney.
Hello there. Hi, everyone.
That's nice.
Thanks.
Shoney.
Thanks for talking about me today.
Okay, go lay down.
Okay.
Good girl.
Night night.
Yes, thank you, Shoney. But for all of those, I know a lot of people did pray for us to find the dog, and sure enough, we did find her. So thank you for everybody that helped us find her.
All right, we got to get on with this interview. We kind of chatted too long.
Thank you so much. And Chuck's interview, really neat stuff. And, you know, I just love to hear about all the different perspectives of the Iditarod and all the race. And so Chuck's going to bring us a new one. And don't forget Dr. Tim Vet Tip right afterward. Tell us, Chuck, how did you get into the whole flying for the Iditarod and or flying in Alaska?
Well, the flying in Alaska kind of started. I was a hunting guide without an airplane, and eventually I needed to have an airplane. So I bought an airplane, bought a Super Cub first, and then started taking flying lessons. That was in the 70s. And the reason I kind of originally getting involved with Iditarod was just when we were up wolf hunting back in the 70s and 80s, especially the early 80s, we would always try to be in McGrath or be in Galena or be in the area when the race was going through, just because it was such a fun scenario to be around. Well, I stopped hunting, guiding, and all that about 1990, and in the late 80s, middle 80s, I started following the Iditarod with people. And it was kind of a change of emphasis on flying where I got out of the hunting totally and developed this sky trekking concept, which is flying people following the race. In this case, I fly them on photographic and fishing safaris in the summertime. And that's about all I do right now is trips in the summer and then Iditarod. And I'm really happy to be out of the hunting. And I've had some, the Iditarod is kind of like the ducks fly south every year. And in the month, in the first 2 weeks of March, instead of hunting wolves, we're following the dogs and having a big party going up the trail with a bunch of friends that we don't see any other time of the year except during Iditarod time.
That's wonderful. So your hunting changed from animals to people on dog sleds. That's kind of great.
And the fishing and the photography and just, you know, showing people a good experience on anywhere from a 1 to 12 day trip around the state of Alaska. But the March is my favorite month of the year up here. The daylight's long, the snow conditions are good, it's warmed up a little bit, and it's just a real fun time being in the bush of Alaska is during that month of March. And there's, I don't know, 40, 50 pilots between the Iditarod Air Force and people like myself that are taking people up the trail, and it's a real fun time to... You just see your buddies that you haven't seen. And then you get to know the mushers and the mushers family and the people that are following the mushers. And every year there's a new group of people that are visiting Alaska during this time with an interest in Iditarod. And so I just, you know, in my literature, I kind of call it the great big party moving up the trail.
That's great. And now, is there certain people that you normally fly for year after year, or do you pick different people, or do they different people pick you, I guess, throughout the years?
It's a combination of all. I have actually been a Cabela's boy for the last 7 years. I flew Joe Runyon for 3 and John Little for 4, and then Cabela's would book another person. I'd take 2 or maybe 3, but generally just another two people. And I've had 2 airplanes where we've had between 4 and 6 people go up. But this is the first year in 7 that I haven't been with the Cabela's, and they've been real good to me, and it's been great working with them. But they've decided to cut some corners and go some different directions with John. So I'm flying this year an Englishman. He and his wife have flown before with me about 4 years ago. And she is actually running the race this year. She was training with Dean Osmar last year and is presently here training. And she's going to be a rookie going up the trail, and I'm going to fly her husband, and we're going to follow her hopefully all the way to Nome.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, you guys, obviously, you're in the Anchorage area, but do you, I guess, tell us about the trail and what your agenda is and how you go about going from place to place.
Well, I have camped it. I've gone in the Super Cub with one person, and I have been camped, and I have done it without camping. And as I've gotten older, I really like to belly up to a nice warm table with meal prepared and have a warm bed to sleep in at night. The only thing that we don't have are hot tubs to get in at the end of the day. But the people that I fly generally are willing to spend a little bit more to have the best conditions that are available along the trail. And my traditional, I've just modified it a little bit this year, and we can get into that in a minute, but traditionally we'll do the first night in Rainy Pass. Well, I'll back up a day. You have the start in Anchorage and then the restart on Sunday, and I'll fly them up to the restart and land on a couple lakes up there as everybody's coming by, and maybe if McKinley's out, we'll go do a little flight see around McKinley. And then on Monday, we leave for Finger Lake and overnight at Raining Pass, and then a couple nights in McGrath, and then a night on the river, whether it's Ruby or whether it's Grayling, depending whether it's North Route or South Route, and then a couple nights in Unalakleet, and then we used to stay at White Mountain, but they had a beautiful lodge there, but they couldn't keep it going, and it's not operational anymore. And so we go right on into Nome for a couple of nights, and then we get the front runners as they come in, usually on Tuesday, and then Wednesday we'll do a trip up to a little village called Unalakleet and shop for some Eskimo art, and maybe go out, and if it's a nice day, we can usually go out and find a polar bear on the ice, and then back to Nome and leave on that Thursday for back to Anchorage. So it's like a 11, 12-day experience from the time you leave Anchorage.
Oh, wow, that is fantastic.
Yeah. And those places that I mentioned are where there are either a combination of good digs for people to sleep in and feed, and also gasoline is a factor that we have to always keep in mind. Last year was the first year that I skipped Rainy Pass. It's probably right now it's the most scenic place on the trail. Great people, the Pearns are running it and doing a fabulous job. But we had 2 years in a row where the winds kicked up at night, and it was really sketchy getting out of there. And at that stage of the race, when you have people that are following front runners, they don't like to get behind. It's better to be out in front and have them come to you and fly backwards than it is to be back and trying to catch up to the front runners.
Good point.
So that's I'm right now we're spending the day at Rainy, but we're moving on to an extra night in McGrath.
Now, Chuck, you said Rainy Pass is one of the scenic. Can you give us a little more of a picture of why it's so pretty there?
Well, it was one of the very first hunting lodges started by the Branhams way back. I want to say the late 40s. It might have been the 50s. But it's log buildings, and it's on a lake right in the mountains. You got mountains 360 degrees, and they're real mountains. They're not Pennsylvania hills, and they're upper Michigan hills. It's just a real, real scenic, very Alaskan atmosphere. If you have an image of wintertime in Alaska with the mountains and the trees and a lake, frozen lake and everything, and smoke coming out of the chimneys, Rainy Pass fits that scenario.
Oh, that's fantastic. So what do you like the most about, not obviously the people and the party moving north, but what drove you to do this in the first place? Was it just the financial side of it, or was it just a great...
Oh, there's always the money. I mean, you can't do it for nothing. It's just a real scenario of, I guess when I first started getting hooked up with it in the late, in the 80s, ABC was doing it on a regular, they had been doing it for year after year after year, and the helicopter pilot, well, even before he had a helicopter, he flew him in a 185 like what I'm doing, and then later on to a helicopter, and his sons flew the 185. That pilot family, which is Tony Oney and Tony Oney Jr. and John Mason Oney, they are my best friends, some of my very best friends. Their kids and my kids grew up together. And then the group that and Tony's still flying for Iditarod right now. He will be flying this year again. The crew that they flew, which is probably the man that knows more about Iditarod than perhaps any other single person around is Peter Henning. And he was the head cameraman. He has an incredible memory for every year and who won what and what were the unique things that happened. But anyhow, that group, which had all kinds of, they had a personality up every year. Football, Donna DeVerona, the swimmer, I remember, and there was just several different people, and it was all a big family. And these guys were back every year, and everybody became really good friends to the point where like Peter would have an Iditarod party back in Connecticut every year in September, and we'd try and get back to it. And that friendship circle grew and grew and grew and expanded outward every year with new people. And that has grown ever since over the 22 years that I've been doing. So it's a heck of a deal.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, we watch from a distance, right? We watch the Iditarod videos and we watch little snippets on the news and the Iditarod website and so forth. You know, I guess, you know, especially I think a couple of years ago, I'm not sure whose helicopter went down. You know, they were okay. Go ahead. Did you know those guys?
I know all that incident. That was 2 years ago.
And I think about that. Is there a lot of danger in flying? Obviously, you said about the wind. Is it a pretty scary thing?
It's safer than driving your car from your house to the grocery store.
That's probably true.
For the number of airplanes that are on the trail every year, and you look back over 20, 30 years of flying, I mean, there have been very, very few wrecks. And most of the pilots, or all of the pilots, are really safety conscious. Most of the pilots are flying for the Air Force. That's what I'm doing is the periphery of that. I mean, we're doing it economically, and it's, you know, to make a nickel. Those guys are flying for free.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there's an amazing group of guys, and but they get their expenses, and that's it. And I mean, some of them put 50, 60 hours a race on their airplane, and that costs them a lot of money. I mean, gas is the cheapest part of running an airplane. But the safety factor, you know, I mean, there's, when you got airplanes, you got boats, and you got cars, you're going to have a hiccup every once in a while. But when you look at the big picture, it's been very, very little, and it's most of it's about judgment and weather. And when the weather isn't right, you don't go. And another factor with the safety thing, March, you can land just about anywhere on skis.
Okay.
Because you have the snow, you know, you have good snow conditions around. And if you have to do an emergency landing, you've got a lot more options at that time of year than you do, say, in the summertime.
Oh, that makes sense. I mean, obviously, you're looking for lakes, and there's a lot of those, but it's a little different, too.
Yeah, well, even the marshes, or, you know, you got all hillsides, and, I mean, you got all kinds of options that you can put in and nobody get hurt.
Right.
Chuck, do you have a story that's at the top of your mind, maybe a favorite one?
Yeah, I got, well, that's not a good one.
How about the wildlife at all?
I don't know. I remember John Little telling us you had.
Oh, John. John remembers one where he was hanging inside. Yeah, it was
not
a few years ago. He said he was hanging inside. Just the plane was just a shaking, and he was white knuckling it, he said. So.
Oh, that was probably. Oh, yeah. That was the Alphamrani Pass. That was one of the times I was mentioning to you. And the winds were gusting, you know, 25, 30, and that's just about the max that you know, if it gets up 40, you just say, to heck with it, guys, we're not going. And there had been a couple planes in and out, and it felt like it was okay, but it was a little uncomfortable, and that was taking off from Rainy Pass, and you got to take off into the hill, and you got a downdraft coming down over the hill when the wind's blowing from that direction. And it was a little gnarly until we didn't go through Rainy Pass. There was an alternative pass up there called Ptarmigan. And then we get around through Ptarmigan, and then the visibility went to quarter, half mile or some ridiculous thing. But it's still, when you're flying down a river, the visibility, as long as you can see down and you got a little forward visibility and you know the trail, you know where you're going, you can poke along and some stuff, and it's not unsafe. And especially when you know at the that in a few minutes you're going to come out into bluebird skies, which we did. Oh. We knew that the reporting stations at Farewell and McGrath were bluebird, and so coming down the South Fork of the Kuskokwim wasn't really, you know, it was a little uncomfortable, but it was a totally safe and totally doable situation.
Now, a lot of us fly in the big commercial airplanes with instrument landing and ILS, all the different things. Do you guys use any instruments, electronic, you know, not just navigation, but...
Oh, yeah, you've got it all, and I'm licensed for it and everything, but you don't do it in a little single-engine airplane.
Right.
I mean, you just, you know, that's all backup stuff, but it's all... And we use our GPSs and stuff, but it's still, you got to have everything memorized, you got to have everything out in front of you, and you got your map there. And you just don't go, thou shalt never fly into a cloud.
Yeah.
With the airplanes that we're flying. And another thing a guy told me years and years ago, you know, you can land one of these little airplanes like we're flying anywhere once and walk. The worst wreck you could have would be in a jet. And you just think about the mass, the weight, the speed, and the amount of fuel that's on board. And something that weighs as much as the big commercial airplanes don't have a whole lot of happy endings when they go down. And these light airplanes, you can put them into a hillside, into bushes or whatever, and it's just like a big spring bed, and you maybe ding up your airplane, but you don't get hurt.
Exactly.
Now,
Chuck, have you ever had a chance to mush at all, or do you mush at all?
No, I really haven't really had any interest in the dog scene. I admire what people do with them. I like the dogs. I like mostly the families of which you mentioned there at the beginning, that whole group. I know the Kings and the Thurs, and I mean, go right on down the line. And I mean, they're just wonderful, wonderful families, and they've built a lifestyle on Iditarod.
Yeah.
And it's just been... For me, it's been a very interesting life experience to be around this group of people and be friends with them.
Now, when you're out there and you get to view some of the mushers as they're traveling, do they know you're there? Or are the planes like circling around a lot of the mushers?
Some of them do, and some of them, I mean, there's so damn many airplanes floating around out there that they can't keep track. But I know that certain mushers know my airplane because I've flown their friends or their family or their wives or something on the trail.
Do you get pretty good close-ups of them, and do you get to see everything they're going through and some of the harder
classes? Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you can be as low as you want and as you're going along, and if I got people that want to take pictures, you know, we can do whatever we need to do.
What's the toughest part of the trail for that you think?
You know, the toughest one is the Dalzell Gorge. It's gotten much better over the years. You know, something that's changed, I'm going to regress here just a little bit on that question, but I'll come back to it. The trail breakers have changed the race considerably over the last 20, 25 years, because these are just a hell of a group of guys that have got their stuff together, and it's the same guys every year, and pretty much. And, you know, they put in these little corduroy bridges and stuff where there's a danger spot, and those things stay, and every year they add to it, and every year the trail gets better and better. But they also break for the front runners, and that's why, you know, regardless of conditions, you know, it's been 15, 20 years that a race has gone past Tuesday, I think, into Nome. And it used to be, you know, 3-4 days variance when the front runners got into Nome. But these trail breakers, you know, and you don't see the wet water crossings, which has been a good deal for the dogs. You have very few streams that they have to plunge across anymore because they got bridges across. And the Dalzell Gorge didn't used to have any of those, and going down through there was a real hairy deal. And it's very narrow. You're on ice ledges. The ledges could work for the first 10 and could break for number 11 that comes down through there. And then they're into the water.
Wow.
And that is not the scenario anymore. But still, the Dalzell is a tough one. And part of it is since they've done the restart from Willow, or from Wasilla or Willow. They don't do it out of Anchorage and ready, set, go on Saturday and keep going. They do the restart now. Well, that means that most of the front part of the pack is doing the Dalziel after dark. That adds another element into it, and that would be Monday night. They're going through the gorge, but that's still the toughest part. And then you know, like the story of Libby, which I'm sure you know, and she won the race by being gutsy enough to take off out of Unalakleet and Shaq Tulik and head out across the ice. That's always a crapshoot. If you've got a storm coming up, that whiteout condition going across there, even as well as they have it marked, that's another place that can be really, really, truly dangerous.
Now, where were you during that whiteout with Libby? Were you flying at that point?
I was not on it that year.
Okay.
That was, I don't remember, what year was that?
It's 85.
There you go.
I think it's 80.
Shame on all of us.
I want to say 85, but I'm not.
85. We were on the front part of the race, but I wasn't out that far. Yeah, we were in the Galena McGrath area when they were coming through, but we didn't go on out to Nome that year.
What happens in some of those blizzards? Do you guys put down or do you try to fly around them?
No. We just you just sit. You tie up and sit and hope your bird doesn't blow away.
Right.
Use ice screws and all kinds of things, but. Yeah, and that happens, you know, from time to time, and Unalakleet especially. I mean, you just get stuck there.
Yeah.
The other dangerous part, the Dalziel, going through, Dalziel is Rainy Pass, but that's the downside of Rainy Pass. And then when you're in the interior, you're basically not in big wind country, and you've got trees, and so navigation and stuff's okay. The Yukon isn't really dangerous, but if you've got a cold wind like you had last year, it's just really a son of a gun for those guys to go into the wind. And I mean, like Dee Dee had a dog team quit on her, just quit out in the middle of the Yukon, and she's not the only one that's had that. But then you get on through from the Yukon over down the Unalakleet to the coast, and that's all pretty good trail as far as navigation And then you go across the ice from Shaq Tulik up to Koyuk. That's one I was just talking about. And then they follow the shoreline around to Elam and over to Golovin and White Mountain. And that's not too bad, although that going across from Elam to Golovin has had some problems when there's a storm going through because it's just totally white out. There's no trees. And I'm trying to think of the name of the Barvey. Man, I'm getting too old on all these things. But anyway, he was stopped for something, and his gloves blew off.
Oh, no.
And Darcy Marsh was flying part of that ABC group that I was mentioning earlier. Darcy was out there with a snow machine filming, and he just happened to come, LaVon Barvey. He came up on LaVon and found his gloves for him. Oh. And I suppose that could be construed as aid, but helping somebody. But he saved him from freezing his hands.
Oh, yeah.
And gave him his gloves back, and just, you know, it all went on from there. But that's a bad spot. And then the other one is from White Mountain on through the Topcock Hills down to the Solomon Seward Peninsula. And that's the one where... Rick Swenson won that one year when Susan and Joe Runyon started out from White with sprint sleds, thinking that they were going to, you know, pick up some time. Rick, and they turned around and came back because it was a horror. I was in Nome at the time, and it was a horrible blow. Rick continued on because he had a bigger sled. This is the way I remember it anyway. He kept his big sled or didn't have a sprint sled, and so he knew that if it got real bad, he could just crawl into his sled and survive. And he made it over the Topcock Hills to that little green cabin that's down there on the coast there, and nobody knew or heard anything about him for a day or two. And then when it broke up a little bit, one of the helicopters saw him or something, and he came on in the Nome, and he won the race that year because of that move.
That's wonderful. It's amazing how just one, gutsy, crazy, however your perspective, you know, how one move can really win the race for you.
Well, yeah, even Martin Boozer did something like that as well.
Yeah, and Libby and a bunch of them. So.
Yep.
Now, there's, you know, no matter who's got it made and who's got it won, there's always that crazy thing that can happen. We always, this is a Peter Henning statement, but he always used to say that the race begins in unk, uniclique. And it's all posturing to that point. In the last few years, it's maybe a little different than that. It's posturing until they do their 8-hour stay on the Yukon.
Yep.
Either the 24-hour or the 8-hour on the Yukon. And that has, where they've done the 24-hour is the last few years has been very, very significant as to who's going to be the winner. But, you know, like a few years ago, it was a beautiful day, and Dee Dee and Martin were running out front. And they came out of Golovin, and they were doing really good, and they got off on a snow machine trail. The marker, they missed the marker, and that somebody else, I forget who it was, went ahead and won that year because of that one little move, and they were way out front.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, it's not done till it's done. For the most part, if somebody gets to White Mountain with 45 minutes or more, that's probably going to be the winner. But then there's always that weather factor and all these other things, and that's what makes Iditarod such a hell of a race.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So now, when you were a little boy, did you think you'd grow up to be a pilot and be so in tune to the Iditarod? You probably never even heard of the Iditarod when you were little, huh?
No. I didn't hear about it. Well, I've been in Alaska since 63, so I knew about it. But I really didn't really become interested in it until the early 80s and that, when I was flying around where I could see part of it. Now, and you know, growing up in Michigan there, my big life's ambition was to go to Yellowstone and go to the mountains in the West. And long story short, I ended up in the mountains in Alaska and been here ever since.
Kept going, huh? Did you get to Yellowstone,
did you
though?
We got to know, did you?
Oh, yeah, that was a big disappointment. But
yeah.
I've been there several times, but back in Michigan, I didn't even know about dog mushing, I don't think. But after going through college, and that hunting was always a draw. I never big game hunted till I came to Alaska, and that captured me. And I spent, you know, a lot of years with that. Was my major drive in life was to hunt different species of game up here. And as you get older, you know, you go through all that, and you do a little bow and arrow hunting, and anymore about all I care to do is maybe a meat hunt with the kids or something, or take my boy brown bear hunting, or do some pheasant hunting out in Dakota. But your interests kind of shift to other things, and skiing and hiking and that. But I've never been bit by the dog mushing thing per se.
Yep.
Yep. Well, we have, and we understand completely how you can and can't be. So we understand. is there a favorite part that you like to travel the trail, and or is something that you say to yourself, you know, I just really look forward to this part? Is it the very end when you can relax, or is there anything part of it?
You know, you relax pretty much the whole way. If you're not relaxed, you shouldn't be doing it because it's not fun. Number one rule is be safe. Number two rule is have fun. I really like from Finger Lake on through the burn to Nikolai. That's an area that a lot of the races have been won and lost in that stretch right there. And then the interior is kind of boring. And then from Unalakleet, it's always exciting. I always feel a little excitement when I come down the river from Caltag on the Yukon, and we cut through the little pass there, and we get on into the Norton Sound area, and then the Norton Sound area on out where you gradually lose all your trees. And it's just all white out country, and those are the two areas that are probably the most exciting to me.
Why do you like Finger Lake area so much? Is it just pretty, or is it just fun to?
Yeah, it's just pretty. It's through the Alaska Range. You know, the interior of Alaska is just, you know, it's flat and it's rolling and it's trees, but it's not what I'd call spectacular if you batch it up to the Alaska Range or the Wrangells or, you know, the Brooks Range or some of the real major mountain systems. And that Finger Lake, or even from Squintna all the way on through to Farewell, is a and you know, even Nikolai and out in the flats there, you look back, and if it's a clear day, you got Foraker and Mount McKinley sticking up there. And so you got just a magnificent backdrop.
Do you get to fly a lot during the day, or is it just from stop to stop, or do you stay in the air for quite a while?
If we have an hour and a half in the air at one time, that's a long time.
Okay.
And except when we leave Nome and come back to Anchorage, then it's a, you know, you got a 3 hour to McGrath and a hour and a half to from McGrath into Anchorage, or 2 hours depending on weather and stuff. But no, it's an up and stop and an up and stop, and most of the time is spent puddling around, especially with these writers that I've had. You know, they got to do a couple satellite sends with their stories. They have to do like four or five a day, so you're waiting on them to get their thing out before you take off. But most of the time, you're spent around the checkpoints and visiting with people or napping or walking around. I don't nap very good, but it's just, you know, walking around doing and talking with folks and waiting on somebody to come in or waiting on somebody to go out.
Now, you know, that reminds me, most of the checkpoints, obviously where you're landing, you've got accommodations and food and that kind of stuff. What are the most...
You have accommodations at the one... Well, there's accommodations at any checkpoint, depending on whether you want to sleep on the floor or not and you want to shower.
Right.
The ones I mentioned are the ones that have, and there's some others that have nice digs. And we go to as many of the 30 checkpoints as possible. Some years the conditions are not safe to land because of ice or wind or whatever, and we do not. And I tell my people going up front that there's two or three of them in particularly that we're probably not going to go into unless the conditions are just perfect for them. But we're spending... Yeah, most of the time of the 10 days you're up the trail is spent in the checkpoints.
Okay, so you're popping, you know, even though you're staying every night somewhere, you're going to stop at three or four checkpoints throughout the day.
Oh, yeah. Like, we go into McGrath, and then we go back to Nikolai, and then the next day we go over to Takotna or maybe over to Ophir, the next one up. There's a place to land there, and you can walk the mile on the trail back to, or they come up and pick you with a snow machine. And yeah, we're back and forth. Just about the only day that I don't think we fly yet normally is the Sunday of Univacleet, because that's where all the action is. They're coming in all day long on Sunday. This year is going to be a whole new experience for me because I'm going to be following a rookie, and I'm assuming... I would love to see her be up in the front of the pack, but I'm assuming she'll be back. And, you know, it's just for her is to finish the race. And so it's going to be a little different deal for me being toward the back half of the pack.
Oh, that's going to be wonderful, though. Hey, have you got to know, is that Kim Franklin that you're taking?
Mm-hmm.
Her husband? Okay.
Yep, Kim Franklin.
And have you got to know them much yet, or just through emails and talk?
Oh, that's a couple. She and Ian, we flew actually two times. It was like in 01 or 02 was the first time they were up. And that was the year that I arranged for her to ride when we were through Ruby. She went with Emmett Peters. I lined up to set up a team, and she got to mush it right down the Yukon by herself. And Emmett followed along in the snow machine, and that's kind of what really tweaked Kim. I mean, she's had the interest because she has dogs in England, but that's where she really got her interest tweaked for doing the Iditarod. And they came back two or three years ago. We were going to go, and Ian had a business emergency that he had to go back, and so Kim wanted to do the trail and had my wife go with her. So that was a fun deal for Kelly to be able to go up the trail, all expenses paid, on the part of Ian.
That's wonderful.
But yeah, they're really fun people, delightful people, and we are in contact. We've been in contact with them ever since they came up here.
Oh, that is neat stuff. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic.
Oh, great.
That's great. And do you still have room for other people to come fly this winter with you?
Not this year. Next year is open.
Next year's open, and
the summer's open.
Yeah.
Or are you all booked all summer already?
No, I've got always got room in the summertime. I kind of take whatever comes up. Summer time's open, and probably my favorite trip is out the Alaska Peninsula for a couple of days, where there's a walrus herd that we can get close to, and bears, and fishing birds, fishing if people want to. And I keep a boat in Saldovia where we can do birds fishing and sea otters, and a nice little hotel to stay there. And then I go up to a lodge in the Wrangell Mountains, or up at Kennecott, and we make a trip out of that. Or the other way, that's probably the best first-time experience for people to come up here. And then the other one is to go to the Arctic and do up through the Brooks Range and the Seward Peninsula, and basically come back following the Iditarod in the summertime from Nome back to Anchorage.
Wow. Great interview. Thank you so much, Chuck, and I hope everybody really enjoyed that. I don't know. Some of the wind and the stories definitely be interesting, but I think I like his idea about actually staying at nice hotels and having warm beds
yeah.
every night.
I could do it. I could do it for sure.
Yeah.
We'd have to pack up some money first, but
yeah,
at the same point, it would be an awesome thing to do. I'm right there with him. Warm bed, warm shower.
Yes.
I'm all about it. I don't know that I could be an Iditarod volunteer.
Oh, sure could if you had the opportunity. So anyways, well, thank you so much.
And remember, you can take a look at Chuck's website at www.alaskaskytrekking.com. That's alaskaskytrekking.com. Just to find more information about him, but look in our show notes if you want to learn more about him and his business, or maybe you want to go fly him, or maybe you want to do the Iditarod with him next year.
Yeah, his website is fantastic. Brand new, like you mentioned. They got a new updated website. Looks great. Lots of photos on it. So it's neat stuff. And off of our website at Sled Dog Podcast, you can get his email and or his website if you need to, because trekking is spelled T-R-E-K-K-I-N-G. And so you can go to the website and get it. So other than that, thank you so much, Chuck. And here comes Dr. Tim with non-traditional training. So, Dr. Tim, tell us a little bit about non-traditional off-season training methods.
Sure. For many years, most mushers in the summertime just leave the dogs on a chain and not do too much with them. There's always a few oddballs out there that are trying to get an edge or to do something still with the dogs because they like to be with them so much. So they start to work with their dogs in the off-season, meaning summertime or when it's warm. And over many years, a lot of these techniques you see today really aren't that new. They've been done before. You know, when I talked to Bill Cotter from Alaska, swimming dogs is something they used to do in the 70s, and it kind of went out of vogue again, and now it's come back again. For instance, what we do is we swim our dogs in a pool that has two jet inlets to it, so we created a current pool so the dogs actually swim against a force, which is about 3 or 4 miles an hour, so they can stay stationary in this current, and then they're exercising without any concussiveness, meaning they're not pounding their legs against the ground or a treadmill. So it's very non-concussive, non-painful type exercise, I should say, but really beneficial. We've seen great dividends with it so far this year in our training and hopefully into our racing season from us spending the whole summer and early fall swimming these guys in a pool. And there are a number of people that are swimming dogs these days from canoes. They lock them on a chain, or they'll just drop them out of the canoe and let them swim back across the lake towards their house. We just don't have a lake right next to our house, so we had to build a pool, and that's the reason why we did that. Otherwise, if we were on a lake, I would do the same thing. I'd use a boat and take them out there and let them swim back to shore. I think that's great exercise for these dogs. A number of people are using wheels, like Evel Ellis, where he has a wheel where these dogs are running around in a circle outside when the weather's affordable for that. Again, because they're not immersed in water, you have to be aware that we have to keep them somewhat cool, where water and summertime temperatures don't make a world of difference. But what he does up there is these dogs will go out, I think, once a day during the summer where they do run, and that's paid big dividends for him. And that, again, is a technique that's been around for a while, but I think he's refined it to another step. The other thing, a lot of free running is happening these days where dogs are going out and just traveling with the four-wheeler but not attached to them, and they can really attain some high speeds, but also they're really stretching out. They might be going 20, 25 miles an hour, which is pretty amazing, and they're just using their body like it's made to use, so it's not constricted by harness, tug lines, or anything else. So I think that's only beneficial for these guys to really stretch it out and to try to do things in the off-season. A number of people are taking their dogs to the glaciers these days to do tours. I'm not real familiar with that. I know they're going a certain distance at a certain speed, and is that beneficial or not? I think the dogs are exercising. But in my opinion, jury's still out on how helpful that might be. I need to talk to some more folks on that as to how beneficial that's really turning out to be. But as we see these different ways people are using their dogs in the summertime, I think it's only an advantage for our dogs in that they're growing a better bond with us. They're getting their physical exercise, but they're also spending more time with us, and it only leads to trust if everything is done nice and calmly, be it the dog pulling you on a bicycle or free running or swimming in a pool for that matter. I think the bond issue is underestimated in that when the going gets tough, it's nice to have that communication with your dog team to help you get through it. So with that in mind, I think there's always ways we can try to benefit our dogs in the off season. And as we watch things go along over the next few years, I'm sure there'll be new and different innovations that have come out that we never even thought of, be it the dog running in a refrigerated truck or who knows what. We'll have to wait and see. It'll be interesting.
I'm curious, with your pool idea, did you have any dogs that didn't like it and wouldn't do it or were too afraid?
Oh, yeah. We put all our dogs through the whole pool setup, and we did have to reject a few dogs in that they just freaked out too much. And it was interesting because we had dogs that were a year and a half up to 9 years of age going to that pool, and it was really a wide swath of the dogs that really didn't dig it. So we gave them a try two or three times, and eventually we just had to give up because they were just too panicked. And other dogs grew after two or three times to enjoy it, and then later on a lot of dogs would just run from their circle up to the top of the deck and wait to go in. So we did have to give up on a few, and that's just how it is. I wasn't going to force the issue. It just was too much stress for them. Okay. But I would say the majority, better than 60 or 70%, took to the water without much fuss after a couple of trials in the water.
So you're going to put three more pools in next summer? And that'll be cool.
I'd like to be able to put more dogs in at one time. We're doing two at a time. But, you know, what I do is we only swim 5 or 10 minutes three times a week, so it's only taking me an hour a night to swim a group of dogs. And then we rotate them through. And it's not practical if you got a huge kennel, but we only have a kennel of 25 or 30 dogs. So with that in mind, it actually was a lot of fun. Our house dogs would come up on the deck. The cats would actually be on the deck. The sled dogs didn't care. They just run up there and they want to go in. They really enjoyed it.
So if I come up with the refrigerated truck escalator built inside, you'd buy one. It's got four dogs.
I've heard people talk about trying to do that. I have to see if anyone actually ever does it. It sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, it does. Unless you have to be in that business or something.
But we're all nuts anyway. We put a lot of work into this whole mess.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tim.
Sure.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tim, for that. And neat stuff. Don't know if we could put a pool. I mean, we could lots of room. We could put a pool in, but
The girls would love it. They'd love for you to put in a pool.
See, pool, lots of hoses, lots of things. Kids can't play in it. Perfect. Actually, I'm up for creating the refrigerated truck, you know, like a big semi-refrigerated truck that maybe somebody doesn't want. You know, it's just laying around. And putting some conveyor belts inside. Wouldn't that be cool? Then you can just sit in there and you can get on your dog sled.
Don't give all your ideas away, dear.
We could get a cart and you could ride in there and the dogs could run and you could actually be on the cart on the treadmill.
Oh, that sounds like how I want to spend my day.
And there's a big 51-inch screen, and you put Iditarod video up there.
We'd need like a big 51-inch screen in our house first.
So it's like an IMAX. You could put it all over the wall. So you could. I'm getting kind of carried away. But hey, if anybody's got that or wants to help me build one, I'd love to work on it with you. So it'd be kind of fun. So other than that, we thank you so much for the show. Don't forget to go out to sleddogpodcast.com. Leave us an email. Tell a friend, please. We'd love to get more emails.
Put us in your newsletter. Let us know that you put us in your newsletter.
Yeah.
Let us know that you put us on your website, because we'd love to thank you for it.
And don't forget, we are looking for the sponsors. So we'd love to promote a product out there just to get the word out and help people, especially the people that are starting out with new products and new ideas and new inventions, and even dog food folks that are creating new dog foods or new formulas. We'd love to promote them. So thank you so much, everybody, and have a great day.
God bless. Happy racing.